Welcome to Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on WPR News. Vijay Pandian is back with us today. He is horticulture agent and educator for the UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. And we're going to talk to him about how to grow blueberries. And of course, we'd like to hear from you. What gardening questions do you have for him? Join in by giving us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Just not going to get used to that. Hi, Vijay. How you doing?
I'm good, Jill. How about yourself?
Real good, real good. So we got more rain today down here, and I think it was yesterday. It was headed north. How's that been affecting you in your job?
Well, certainly like anyone else, it's hot and humid, actually, and
yes.
That means a lot of diseases, fungal diseases to bacterial diseases, that seems to be more prominent. And this is not the best year for crab apple tree. I haven't found a single nice crab apple tree. They all look so shady. And to be honest, you know, most of the leaves are done for the season, it seems like.
Oh, dear. So, well, what about blueberries? They're difficult to grow in general. Has all this rain made a difference for them?
It's not the rain. I think it is actually the heat. That makes a lot of difference, actually. In the last 10 to 12 years, I've been experimenting with trying to grow blueberries in different types of growing conditions and growing types, okay, apple tea. And my research started back like from Green Bay when I was there as a horticulture educator. Say, back in the time, many gardeners comes to me actually with some dead blueberry plants after 3 years. They've been trying to plant them and trying to grow them. It ends up in failure, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So I started actually doing some experiment. As you all know, blueberries are very picky on the soil pH conditions.
Right.
They really need acid soil. And half of the southern part of Wisconsin doesn't have that kind of, acidic soil. So generally, we have a pH range in the southern part of Wisconsin, slightly more than 7. Perhaps in northern Wisconsin, they have an ideal condition, like in Bayfield County, Marinette County. So they have a slightly acidic soil, and they were able to grow blueberries successfully in the soil. So one of my challenges, how do I actually create, a recipe, a soil-less recipe to sustain the blueberry growth? And so one thing I did was like growing in a containers first started. And then from the containers, I expanded to growing them in a trench, like a 6 by 4 feet in a trench system. And the last 4 years, I've been experimenting in trying to grow them in a raised bed situation. So each of these systems has its own unique success as well as some challenges as well, too. So one other thing that I really like to see that I've been seeing in the raised bed situation is that, some other varieties seems to be performing better in the raised bed, partly because actually in a raised bed, it provides a very good drainage. So the roots expand enormously very well. So when you have a very good root system, the foliage growth is also increases tremendously, as well as, the fruit production goes further up. So in the raised bed system, it's also very comfortable for many backyard gardeners, even though if your soil has a very tough soil, you don't have to worry about it. Or if you have a trees nearby and wondering about the tree root competition, you don't have to worry about it by growing in a raised bed situation. So there are a lot of some advantages in growing some raised bed situation as well, too. And this year is phenomenal. With all the rains that we got, blueberries are growing really very well in the raised bed system because the excess moisture drains out very easily in the raised bed system.
Well, that's great news because I know you've been studying them, like you said, for quite a while now. So you're kind of getting to the end of, okay, this is the best way to do it. What kind of soil are you using in that raised bed?
So that's a very good question. The main ingredient is actually a soilless media is combination of peat and pine bark. Now, you can get a bale of peat in any garden center, And also you can get a pine bark or pine needle. Say the pine bark that I get is a mini nougat, small size, about like a half an inch size type of pine bark. You can also get that actually in garden centers as well too. So you mix them like 1:1 ratio. So originally when I did the study, I also added a third ingredient called perlite. But over the time, I found out that it is not needed. Say just to save some cost, a combination of 1:1 peat and the pine bark would be very helpful. You can also add pine needles, but don't add any other type of leafy materials like, you know, your compost, your oak leaves, or, you know, any other kitchen scraps or anything into those things. Some people even ask me, can I add some like in a used or spent coffee grounds? You know, no, don't do those kind of things, okay? Mm-hmm. So just go with these two ones. Now, you may ask me, what is the science behind these two ingredients? So the key is actually, so when you plant your blueberry plant in this type of soilless media combination with the peat and pine, you also need to add a third element called sulfur, elemental sulfur. This sulfur helps in reducing your soil pH. And this peat and pine bark really sustains that actually acidity in the soil. So generally, if you add sulfur directly into your soil, it gets leached out with the rain and the pH comes back again very quickly. Whereas in the peat and pine bark, it sustains that elemental sulfur very easily and can able to stabilize the soil, acidic soil pH for a long period of time. So in the springtime, every year in the springtime, add a handful of elemental sulfur in the peat and pine bark media. You sprinkle it, and you may want to time it based on when you're going to schedule your irrigation or based on time it on the forecast, okay, the rain forecast. And so that the elemental sulfur gets leached out and can also reduce your soil pH within a short period of time, like within a month or so.
So it sounds to me, I grew up in the UP where there is blueberries everywhere, basically. Yeah. And it really sounds like you're duplicating the kind of soil that I think the blueberries like. Was that kind of your idea when you were putting these together?
Well, sort of. In northern part of Wisconsin, they do have a natural parent material, which is mostly a granite-based parent material rock. So when this granite material starts actually leaching out, becoming more of a soil type, they naturally have an acidic type of soil here. So here in our southern part of Wisconsin, it's more of a limestone bedrock that we have, and that generally makes the soil more alkaline. And the blueberries don't like it because the blueberries need iron, the micronutrient, which is mostly available for them to uptake only in the acid soil. So, we can't actually haul the soil from northern part of Wisconsin or to grow them in a container, In order to, as an alternative, we are using a combination of peat and pine bark. Some people may think, peat is a non-renewable thing. Why can't we use actually coconut coir? You can use coconut coir as well too, but the problem is that you need to have a very big bulk quantity of it, and it can be very expensive.
Okay. I was going to ask about that because I knew someone was going to call in about the peat because I know that there's questions. We do have a caller, though. We've got Donald in Iron River who has a comment for us. Go ahead, Donald.
Hi, I live in Bayfield County, northern Wisconsin. It's not polite to brag, but I've got 67 blueberry plants wild.
Wow.
On my property.
Well, I would brag about that too, Donald.
That's awesome, Mr. Donald, because, in Bayfield area, when I got my first job in Wisconsin, it was stationed up in Ashland, Bayfield County. So I had a privilege of working with some of the Bayfield fruit growers. And so you have the natural soil, actually, to grow some of those blueberry plants right up there. Kudos to you, actually. If you do have those kind of natural soil, try experimenting with some different varieties of blueberry plants. Some of the blueberry plants are very flavorful compared to other varieties. So experiment with some lot of different varieties. Some of the unique varieties also available too, like pink popcorn and something like that. So, you should enjoy those kind of, using those kind of varieties and try to see, how their growth and performance in the natural soil is.
Yeah, I'd be tempted too, because he doesn't have to amend his soil. So, Donald, experiment. Call us back and let us know how it goes. Although right now he doesn't have to do anything because they're just living on their own. So I guess I can understand why he wouldn't want to have to do all that work. We were talking about varieties. So you said we're warmer down here than up north. Are there varieties that do better with warm temperatures?
Well, we're not that extremely, you know, I mean, we are a bit warmer, but generally, here's a few things that I learned, actually, in the last 10, 12 years. No matter what variety it is, most of the blueberry plant that has been recommended for a temperate zone, for like an upper Midwest area, they don't tend to tolerate temperatures not more than 90 degrees. So no matter what, how much you pump some water, when the plant gets to more than 90 degrees, simply they start to shut down itself. And especially if it's a first year planting, oh my God, like in 2021, we had one of the worst drought in Kenosha County. And that's a year I started my blueberry variety trial in Race Bad. I've been experimenting with a 15 different variety. All of them failed because that year was not only the drought, but the heat was like more than 90 degrees. And so I have to redo my experiment back again. Mm-hmm. So every year in the raised bed, the first year of the planting is always a bit more vulnerable for blueberry plant, especially if the temperature goes to more than 90 degrees for a few days. The leaves will turn into like a reddish color, and they get really stressed out. And they simply tend to get into shock mode. And it stays for a while. But if the temperature still persists more than 90 degrees for a few more days or like more than a week or so, then you're going to start to see some like severe injuries on those canes. And that makes it vulnerable for winter stress. And they may or they may not survive for the next year. So you may want to be very careful in choosing a site location when you're planting your blueberries. So I'll get to the variety part in a bit. So the first thing I would think about, you know, when you're choosing a, you know, site location, either you want to go in a raised bed, trench, or in a container, make sure that you don't place them right next to any kind of like a driveway or any kind of like a concrete slab nearby. Don't place any of those things. Second is because of the excess heat actually coming radiating from those kind of concrete blocks or from the driveway can further aggravate, you know, the heat stress on your blueberry plant. Second thing, especially if you're placing your blueberry plant in a full sunny area, the southwest side where the winds usually hit, picks up, that area, you need to have some sort of like a windbreak. So maybe you can have about like a 25 feet from that place, you know, if you have a windbreak type of protection, either having a hedge or maybe a snow fence or something like that, that could minimize the wind effect. That would be very helpful for the blueberry plants. So being said that, there are a lot of varieties that will really tend to do very well, both in raised beds as well as in trenches. So in the raised bed, some of the varieties that's been most successful are some of the high bush type, like Chandler was phenomenal. Even in the second year, it started producing a lot of fruits actually on a plant. Blu-ray, I love the taste of the Blu-ray plant. It is very sweet. Chandler has more of a little bit of an acidic flair, you know, taste to it when I tasted it. Aurora is another nice variety to try. Any of the Northern series is also really good. That includes Northland, North Sky. Those are really good varieties as well, too. Polaris is also another nice variety to try. So here's some good varieties, you know, that you can try. Blue Crop, I forgot to mention, they're also a very productive plant. So you can experiment all the different varieties that's in a hardy for Wisconsin area.
Well, yeah, there's a lot more than I thought, for sure. Our guest today is Vijay Pandian. He's a horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. What gardening questions do you have for him? Join in by giving us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Try to stay with us for the entire 2 hours of Garden Talk today. And that last half hour, we're going to talk about how to keep your planters looking great all season long. Right now, we're looking at blueberries, and we have a couple callers waiting. Samantha and Whitehall, go right ahead.
Well, this isn't really about blueberries, but I suppose it's the same type of deal if you're transplanting blueberry bushes as opposed to anything else. But how would you transplant like a blackberry bush or a raspberry bush or even a blueberry bush from the woods to your, you know, by your house? How would that work? You know, like if you wanted to take some and transplant it, how would, you know, what would you have to do to get the soil ready or something like that?
Okay, that's a great question. So here's a few things you need to know. Some of those wooded type of wooded varieties like that you find in the woodland areas, including a blackberries or a, you know, raspberry type, first of all, be cautious about them. These, you know, wild type of brambles, they may not be that much productive, or they may harbor some diseases in it. And so you may want to exercise some caution in trying to transplant them from that area back into your garden. So generally, I would avoid it. But if you still insist, no, I really want to do that, okay, then probably early in the springtime would be the best time to do. And so, you know, you could actually, you know, scoop up the plant along with the crown and see as much as root as you can possible, you know, along with it. And then you can plant them, you know, in a desired spot location that has a full sun in it. Now, the few things you need to remember, the blackberries, they can really get very robust in its growth. Sometimes in a perfect soil condition situation, some of those canes can go 5-6 feet. So you may want to think about properly training them and pruning them. Same thing goes with the raspberry as well, too. Like I said, there are a lot of new varieties of blackberries and raspberries available. Consider that rather than actually scooping out from the woodland areas because, you know, they may have diseases, they may not be that productive. So, you know, check into those things.
And isn't there a problem with taking plants from woodland areas? You have to have permission if it's owned and things like that, too, right?
That's most for endangered species. So I don't think these are all endangered species, but, you know, it's always good to check with the local DNR folks about it.
Okay, great. Jeff in Suamico, go right ahead.
Hi. I have three different varieties of blueberry bushes, and I'd like to propagate them. I'm wondering, is it too late in the season to take cuttings? I checked them this morning, and the new growth is still pretty pliable and kind of a bright green. And so I'm wondering if I missed my opportunity. The other thing is, do you have a rooting compound that you would suggest? I see some of them say that you shouldn't use them for edible plants.
So in terms of propagating blueberry plants, especially if you're going to take a softwood cuttings, then probably you are a bit late, I would say. Right now, the blueberries actually are in full, you know, mature stage. It's ready for harvest. So they have spent quite a bit of energy in producing the fruits right now. So the remaining green matter, they're going to actually start, you know, using it for, you know, synthesizing the flower bud for next season. So right now, they're not growing that very well, those, you know, so you don't have that much of auxin support right now on the new growth. So being said that, you know, it is better actually to do that probably in the month of June to take some of the softwood cuttings, you know, and then you can propagate them in a, you know, in whatever the propagation bed that you have. Now, in terms of using a growth hormone, yes, you can use any kind of root hormones you can use. I don't have any issue, actually. I didn't see any kind of issue that would cause any kind of negativity on the growth of the plant. You know, so if it doesn't propagate very well, you can typically use any type of IBA type of root hormone to promote some, stimulate some roots in it. Yeah.
Okay, Jeff, thank you for the question. If you have a question for Vijay, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And you can also send us an email. That's talk@WPR.org. So basic question, Vijay, do you need more than one blueberry plant?
Yes. I mean, there are certain varieties that are self-compatible, certain varieties that do require some cross-pollination. say, in order to avoid all this confusion, it is better actually to have, you know, a few different varieties, at least two different varieties, okay, to enhance the pollination requirement and so that you can get a very good crop. But like I said, there are certain varieties like St. Clouds, you know, they can self-pollinate itself. But so wind and bees helps in pollination purpose. So when you go to plant them in a row or something, plant them in a staggered row fashion. Give about like, you know, 3-4 feet spacing, at least I would say if you're going to plant them in ground. Now, if you're planting in a raised bed or in a trench system with the soilless media, then you don't have to give that much of spacing. I have planted my blueberries about only about 2.5-3 feet apart in a staggered row. So it's more of a high-density planting system with the multiple different varieties right up there.
And if you plant the blueberries in a container like you were talking about before, what do you do with them in the winter?
That's an excellent question. So if you're going to think about planting in containers, because sometimes people, you know, we may not have enough space in a outside, or you may live in an apartment situation that, you know, you have only a space in a balcony or patio type of situation. In those kind of circumstances, planting in a container would be a right choice. If you think about containers, few things you need to know about the downside of it. I know it might be like a space-saving thing. It's easy to and portable and all those things. Blueberry roots are very finicky. They get easily heat stressed. So when you're choosing a container, don't you select containers which are black in color because the black tends to absorb more heat. Say, select some different colors of containers if possible. Second of all, choose the right varieties for the container. Don't go with a high bush or, you know, half high bush type of varieties and plant them in a container. Use more of a, you know, a low bush variety. Low bush varieties, they're more like a mounding type. Okay, they get only a maximum 12 inches tall, and then they have a more of a spreading type nature to it. And they can easily fit in the container size. Okay, start with about at least 5-gallon container. And then every year you can increase, you know, every 2-3 years, you can actually repot it and go to a larger size container. And say, like, one variety is like a top hat. You know, that's an excellent low bush type variety that can be used. Now, in the winter time or in the late fall time, here's what you need to do. There are two options you have how to overwinter them. One option is that if you do have any protected spot in your landscape, like between the two sides of your building or, you know, north side of your building, dig a trench to bury the entire container all the way down to the ground, mulch it with some like wood chips or pine bark or something, and then put up a chicken wire around to it. The reason is that the ground is a good insulation, you know, to protect it from the cold temperature, and that way you can easily overwinter it. Now, the other option is, no, I don't have any kind of like outdoor spaces. Your best other option is to put them back in your garage or in your basement, cold basement. If you have an unheated garage, what I would tend to do, I would put up a styrofoam pad on the floor of the garage and then place the blueberry plant on top of it and mulch it heavily with either with styrofoam or for any type of, you know, mulching materials. And that's one way to do it. The key thing is that the root should not be frozen. So sometimes when we do have a polar vortex or something like that, you know, we want to make sure that no cold air sneaks inside a garage and freeze the roots out. So these are the two different ways that you can protect your blueberries, you know, during the wintertime.
And if they're in the trench or if they're in a raised bed, do we have to do something kind of similar?
So that's a very good question. In the raised bed system, originally when I was thinking about raised bed, I was very afraid about it. Like, you know, your bed height is about like a 10 to 12 inches high, whether the root's going to get frozen or not. Say my bed size was like 8-foot by 8-foot bed size, okay? Say it's a pretty large size raised bed. And the volume of the media was sufficient enough actually for the help them to overwinter very easily. If you're thinking about a very small size raised bed, so let's say about like only about 2 feet by 4 feet, okay, in a small size, then I would think about mulching it with some like a pine bark. Go about like 6 inches of pine bark on top of the, you know, the blueberry plants, okay, and mulch it heavily. But on a bigger size raised bed or in a trench system that's about like a 4 feet by 6 feet or 4 feet by 8 feet, you know, you don't have to worry about mulching it or doing anything special for overwintering it because the soil helps in actually, you know, overwintering those roots very easily.
Okay, that makes all kinds of sense. If you've got a call or got a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. All our lines are open. So then looking past blueberries, what kind of problems are you seeing this year? I know we talked briefly about all the extra water, but specifically, are you seeing more certain diseases or insect problems?
Well, in the landscape scenario, I mean, we've been saying all kind of, you know, diseases issues in terms of like, you know, bacterial blight on, you know, lilac bushes, you know, black spots on roses. Some of the roses are looks awful.
Yes.
It looks very bad bone because of the black spot diseases that's been very rampacious. And the apple scab disease seems to be common. You know, it's all related to the humidity. The humidity seems to be very high this year, and it's been wonderful for many of the fungal diseases, including the tomatoes. You know, you have early blight, you know, you have septorial leaf spots, you know, they're all happy and glorious, you know, this year, it seems like. I mean, our state specialist, Dr. Amanda Govens, is watching out for late blight. So far we have, I mean, I haven't heard in a backyard gardener situation a late blight, but there seems to be a detection in central part of Wisconsin. So that's something to be, you know, we should be aware about it and keep eye on your tomato plant. Late blight could be a very deadly disease. I mean, in terms of bug issue, there is a lot of sap-sucking bugs all over the place. In a aphid seems to be very high. I mean, with all the rain that we got, you know, I heard some people, the pollinator population, especially some monarchs and butterflies, that seems to be in a bit down this year, it seems like. Say, our state specialist, P.J. Leash, is also hearing the same thing about it.
So we're not getting as many pollinators as we normally would? Is that what you're saying?
That's what it seems like.
Okay.
The trend seems like, you know, say, a few weeks ago, I got an email from one of the local gardeners, and the master gardener, you know, also shared the same concern about, you know, they're not seeing that many monarch butterflies in their garden that they used to see it, even though they have the milkweed plants and everything, you know, so.
Yeah, I've got milkweed all over. It pops up everywhere, but I haven't seen one monarch yet this year, so it's kind of unusual.
It seems to be. Mm-hmm. Say, that seems to be the trend this year. It seems like, you know, a very low numbers of pollinators, especially the butterflies, okay? So something to keep an eye on to it. But if you do have any type of pollination issue, be free to reach out to our state entomologist, P.J. Leash, about it. Let him know. He keeps a good track, actually, in what's going on in the state.
And I think we probably have PJ coming up fairly soon. Oh, no, I'm looking at the calendar now. Maybe in September that we'll have him or Phil back to answer your questions. And, you know, we were talking about tomatoes earlier. Last few weeks, we've had a lot of calls from people who are having problems with their tomatoes in this year, and they're not getting a lot of blossoms and consequently not a lot of fruit yet, and they seem to be late. Have you found that to be the case, too?
So we are actually technically 2 weeks ahead in our growing season. And even though we are technically 2 weeks ahead, that being said that, with the amount of rain that we got, many tomato plants are being actually very slow to get started. That's because of too much moisture in the ground causing actually the start of some early blight diseases and septorial leaf spot. These diseases cause us a tremendous defoliation, and that in turn affect actually the blossoms and the fruit production. When you don't have that much of leaf, the plants may not have enough energy to produce a flower bed and set the fruit. So that would be one issue that I'm seeing actually. And second of all, you know, with too much rain, too much loss of nutrients. So when you do have a lot of nutrient loss, your lower set of leaves will start to turn yellow. And that indicates that there's a lack of nitrogen. And when you don't have enough nitrogen, the plant's not going to set that much of, you know, foliage growth. And when you don't have enough foliage growth, then you're not going to get enough blossoms, and you're not going to get a good quality food. So all these things and are all triggered by the rain, the excess amount of rain that we got. And the third thing, when you have too much moisture, you know, we have most of the soil in the southern part of Wisconsin, it's a heavy soil. Too much rain causes in a clogging condition, and which creates a perfect spot for root rot diseases. So I've seen some cases in my community gardens over here in a Sturdivant facility that some of the plants have been dead because of the root rot issue. So these are some common factors that we're seeing, actually, that too much moisture affecting the growth of your tomato plant.
excuse me. So if we need to fertilize because we're, you know, it's everything's washing out, the nitrogen, what would be your suggestion for the kind of fertilizer we should get?
So, I mean, we have both organic and synthetic-based fertilizer. Like organic fertilizers, you know, you can use like, you know, chicken poultry waste, fish meal, and you know, all those things. And for synthetic, like 10-10-10, those kind of things. Now, no matter what type of fertilizer you're going to use, the key thing about fertilizing your annual vegetable crop is a fast-releasing type of fertilizer. You need to have a fast-releasing nitrogen type because the plant doesn't have enough time to sit in the ground to wait for the slow-releasing fertilizer to kick in. So you need to have a fast-releasing nitrogen-based type. Say, when you think about fast-releasing nitrogen type, urea-based in terms of synthetic fertilizers are available, like 10-10-10, which has pretty much 10% nitrogen, mostly composed of fast-releasing nitrogen. When you think about organic fertilizer, most of the organic fertilizer are slow-releasing type. It may take about weeks and months for them to release, actually, and the plant to uptake it. So plants may not react very quickly to slow-release type of organic fertilizer. But there are some exceptions here. There are some fertilizers, organic fertilizers, like, you know, fish meal, blood meal, or sometimes, you know, some of the chicken poultry waste type of, you know, fertilizers do have a combination of slow and fast-releasing type. You can use those kind of things. But the downside is that when you use fish meal and blood meal, it'll stink, actually, and you might attract some rodents in it, too. So be aware about those things.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good point. We had a listener email us. Apparently, Japanese beetles are destroying their raspberry bushes. They have been told that 7 is the only thing that works, but as an organic gardener, they're reluctant to use it. Is it safe for fruit that you're going to eat? What do you suggest?
Well, first of all, the very first thing I would do is that if you do have a Japanese beetle, you're in the morning hours, okay, they are very slow and sluggish. Handpick them and drown them in a soapy water, okay? You can easily do that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So before you start thinking about spraying and everything, you know, you can try to minimize it. Second thing, you know, you can also get some like a fine netting material, less than quarter-inch mesh size type of netting material. If you go on Amazon, you can get those type of netting materials that will really help. And you can drape it onto your raspberry plants easily. And the Japanese beetles are not smart enough, actually, you know, to crawl underneath that. They, think about, you know, using a fine mesh netting materials, which are less than quarter inch size. That may be one type you can actually act like a more of a physical barrier to prevent those Japanese beetles to come in. I mean, the third option is, yes, you can. Probably you may want to think about using some sort of organic type. Probably you can use some azadirachtin type of material. Azadirachtin is like a neem-based product. Now, when you're shopping for neem-based, what you're getting in your garden center is more of a clarified hydrophobic type of oil materials, which means that it's pretty much a junky material that has been extracted, all the active ingredients extracted from the neem, and only the remaining junky material that has been sold to you guys. When you go actually online or go to a wholesale department, you can get the real active ingredient, the azadirachtin, And you can use that. And neem has more of a repulsive type of compound to it that will help in repelling some of these Japanese beetles. And it'll last about 5 to 6 days, and then you might come back and respray back again. So these are some of the options that you have, but think about handpicking, think about netting materials before you're going to choose any type of organic or inorganic type of spray.
And the neem oil wouldn't affect the fruit?
No, it shouldn't. Okay. Always read the product label. That I have to mention it very correctly. Follow the rate, follow the directions.
That's always a great advice on that, for sure. UW Horticulture Extension Educator Vijay Pandian is our guest today. What gardening questions do you have for him? All our lines are open. We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show, and I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us again on Monday. We'll be talking to an attorney who specializes in elder law. And then at 12:30, we'll hear about a town in Wisconsin that is going all out to celebrate the 85th anniversary of the Wizard of Oz movie. And that starts at 11 on Monday. Hope you can join us. Right now, we're talking to Vijay Pandian regarding pretty much everything. I think you can answer, Vijay. And we do have some calls. So let's go to Mike in Madison. Go right ahead, Mike.
Hi. I had a comment about the blueberry bushes and establishing them in southern Wisconsin.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Yeah, we put three blueberries in, and I can't tell you the variety, but they're all three are different. So they come ripe at different times of the year, and we've had phenomenal luck with them. So right now the production is slowing down a lot, but for the month of July, we pick about every 5 days, and we have gotten 2 kilos every time we pick out of these three bushes. So it's been really good. It's the history of this large volume has been consistent for the last 10 years. One plant is starting to wane, so we're thinking of replacing it. And one comment about using peat moss. We did use peat moss when we planted these, but I've heard that harvesting peat can release methane into the atmosphere. Even though peat's a renewable source, wonder if Vijay could comment on that.
Okay. I'm so jealous, Mike. I love blueberries.
I'm glad to hear that. You know, you have a very good production of blueberries in your backyard. I mean, in fact, nationwide, we have a tremendous amount of production of blueberries, about more than 700 million pounds of blueberries. And majority of those blueberries, are consumed by North Americans. And, our per capita consumption is almost close to 2.3 pounds, so that's incredible. And so I'm really glad that you're able to harvest and grow and harvest some of the blueberries in your own backyard so you can have the fresh taste of some of those blueberries. I see that you are trying to replace with one of the blueberry plants. If you do, consider some varieties like Blu-ray. You'll be happy about the taste and the quality of the Blu-ray variety. Now, in terms of peat, peat actually is a non-renewable thing. And, it typically grows in a high humid, like a boggy situation condition. And, and in those kind of wetland boggy situation, when you harvest the peat, it takes ages for them to come back again. And that's really a concern about in using peat. Most of the peat comes from Canada and from that area. And these peats tends to be more slightly acidic in nature. There are different grades of peat available, some of them but slightly acidic, some of them more neutral type. Again, yes, it is a non-renewable type of material, plant material. It grows in a boggy condition. And yes, it can be, an issue down the road. I mean, it can be an issue even right now when you harvest too much of peat. So again, as an alternative, you know, you can use coconut coir. And I think, you know, down the road, I see that going to be a lot of import of coconut coir, in the upper Midwest area, and that can be used actually as an alternative to peat. If I do find any other materials, I'll continue to do my research and figure out if there is any other alternatives available. But in terms of connections with the release of excess methane, that I'm not really sure. I'm not aware about it. Maybe, you know, I haven't digged into it so far. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mike, for bringing that up. Let's go now to Robert in Milwaukee. Go ahead, Robert.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have some zucchini. I think they're really like winter squash, but you can sort of pick them early in my garden. I've been growing it the past few years. And each year I had terrible time with these little squash bugs. They would lay eggs on the bottom of the leaves, and I would pick them off, but it was always a battle. This year, there are none. There's no eggs. There's no bugs. There's really nothing. It's really incredible. And I wanted to ask, one thing I did different is I have had a lot of Queen Anne's lace volunteer, obviously, and dill's volunteer dill. And most of it, I let it go. I didn't pick it. And I wanted to know if you thought why the bugs didn't, those bugs weren't there. And maybe the fact that there were other things in the garden that attracted pollinators and maybe attracted birds that helped take care of that.
Go ahead, okay. Vijay.
Say, squash bugs are very common in, you know, especially if you go in any type of wine crops like pumpkins and squash, okay, or even like goats and melons, and they tend to lay the eggs, okay, underneath. Now, in terms of the population of why you didn't see the squash bug this year, whether that is a companion planting, like what you see, like a dill or something that attracted them, that's something is very interesting to see. I haven't heard anything about, in terms of, you know, science-based, I haven't heard anything about dill or some wild character actually acting as a trap plant, you know, that can control the squash bug. I haven't came across the science-based information, but if you do find those kind of things, those bugs habitating actually in that, that's great. But one thing that is a science-based information is that if you try some Hubbard squash, a Hubbard squash, you know, can attract these kind of squash vine borers and squash bugs actually, and can be used as a trap plant in your garden. But make sure these Hubbard squash are planted on the perimeter of your garden, okay, so that you can able to attract them without hindering your main crop. But besides that, I really don't know. I don't know what connection it has actually in terms of the lesser number of squash bugs in your garden versus the dill and the you know, other plants that you have, you know, as a trap plant. Is there any connections to it? I don't have a science-based information on that.
That'd be interesting experiment to do, though, because if that works, I think everybody's going to be growing it. So thanks, Robert. Thanks for sharing that. If anybody else out there has had that kind of experience, please give us a call. Let us know. Number is 800-642-1234. And Ellie in Eau Claire, what questions do you have?
Well, I have had a blueberry hedge that I put in 10 or 12 years ago. And other than when branches break, I have not pruned it at all. And this year, it definitely needs to be pruned. I've had tremendous, like everybody else, I've had a tremendous amount of blueberries this year. The branches are so heavy with blueberries, they're weeping down on the ground. And I'm picking like every other day. So it's, anyway, I've had a great year for blueberries. But how do you prune blueberries? And do the new berries grow on new growth or old growth?
That's an excellent question. So the few things you need to know about blueberry, you know, flower buds. So generally, the blueberry plants produces two different types of bud: the flower bud and the mixed bud are called vegetative buds. The flower buds are usually located on the terminal ends of the branches. And that's where it gets a lot of maximum light. And that's where you're going to see all the flower beds are. So when you plant them as a hedge, you need to be aware not to do any cookie cutting or not to do any type of shearing. If you do some shearing, you're going to lose all the flower beds. And these flower beds actually, you know, are produced right during in the midsummer time. So once you're done with the harvesting, say right now is the peak time for harvesting blueberry crops. Once you're completely done, the blueberry plants will start producing and allocating the resources for next year's flower bed production. So they will start to allocate the resources to initiate the flower bed for next year. So they usually set the flower beds on the last, you know, for example, for 2025, by 2024, it will start to produce that. Now, usually these canes are very productive for 3 to 4 years. So you can get the fruit crops in second year cane, third year cane, fourth year cane, and, you know, and in the fifth year, you will start to see that the cane may not produce that much of flowers. So you can carefully choose the fifth year cane and you can prune them off. Say those canes are pretty old canes. It is so visible. They are more about like a little more than like a pencil size. Little, I would say about like a half an inch size, maybe more than that. And you can cut those canes off. You can thin them up during in the late winter, early spring before the new bud emerges. And that will really open up the space for some new first year canes to come out of them, you know. So that's one way to prune the blueberry plants. Blueberry pruning is very easy. It is not like a raspberry or any other bramble species, which are very pain. So they are relatively, you know, easy to prune. The major pruning is done after 4 years later. You pull some of those, you know, fifth year cane. You do a thinning cut on those things. You cut to the point of its attachment and remove them. If there is any other broken canes or any kind of like a very, you know, overcrowded situation, then you can selectively thin some of them. If not, just leave it like it is.
Okay, thank you very much, Ellie. Let's go on to Penny in Winona County up in Minnesota. Go right ahead, Penny.
Yes, hi. We wanted to put in some fruit trees at our house, and my husband was suggesting planting them on this slope that's behind our pole barn because he's tired of mowing it. And I didn't know if you could plant fruit trees on a slope.
Well, certain fruit crops do like in a better yard flow movement and depends upon which side the slope is, okay? But again, that will be very good to, you know, minimize some humidity. But at the same time, planting in a slope, you may want to encounter like issues like, you know, drought conditions very easily, because if it's in a southern slope, probably you're going to face a lot of heat stress, and that means that you need to pump a lot of more water to it. So that will be a big issue on it. But certainly, you know, if you do want to give a try, go with some sort of like apple varieties and see how they're performing in that slopey area. But again, like I said, you may want to, you know, caution by planting and by watering them in a frequently, or set some sort of like, you know, a drip irrigation system to compensate the, some of those losses of water that goes on in that area. You can also always try some tart cherries. So, you know, they can also, you know, fairly produce decently very well in Wisconsin. So you can also try that too.
Okay, thank you for that call, Penny. I think that sounds like a great place to put them, kind of like grapes, right? Aren't grapes good on a slope?
Yes, the grapes, absolutely, because they have a very good yard flow movement. But when it comes about grapes, it is a bit of a high maintenance in terms of pruning and training. That's one of the reasons why I was a bit hesitant to recommend it. Unless you're a serious gardener, then you can think about it. But if you're in a gardener, which is like a low maintenance type, probably think about some of those, you know, apple varieties, which are more of a dwarf varieties of apples. That'll be good. Or some tart cherry type, you know, that are like a North Star, you know, tart cherries available. That's also relatively, you know, a low maintenance type. So that's always a really a nice thing, okay? But if you absolutely, you can also put some grape wine, but it requires a little bit of more tedious work.
Okay, well, thanks for all that advice. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadone. We're going to be back in a little bit, so make sure you stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Glad to have you with us on WPR. And we're talking with Vijay Pandian, horticulture educator for the UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. What gardening questions do you have? We had a little technical problem earlier, but all our phones are working now, so give us a call, 800-642-1234, and you can always send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. Let's go right off to Darlene in central Wisconsin. She's got another blueberry question. Hi, Darlene.
Hi. I have a large anthill formed underneath one of my blueberry bushes, and I'm wondering if that's going to cause a problem and if I should get rid of it. And also, my berries this year are, they're productive, but I don't feel like they taste as good as usual, and the berries are going soft on the plant sooner. And when you pick them, those little tiny stems that you don't normally only get a few of, it's like they're always coming off with the berries, making them harder to clean.
Well, regarding to your ant situation, the ant hill, the field ants, I mean, with all the rain that we have, you know, we've been getting a lot of complaints about, you know, the ant hill and the ant mound, not only in a farm field situation, but also in your lawn situation as well, too. I mean, so far, you know, the damage caused by this type of ant hill is very minuscule. I haven't seen to that extent of damage on an established plant. If you do have a new plant, then probably, yeah, that is a good possibility. But I would still keep an eye on to it. But if you do find, yes, that is a problem, then you can use some sort of like a products like that's used for recommending to control the ants in the outdoor situation. You can follow the label rate and instruction, and you can, you know, drench it into those ant hills. So that is a possibility that you can think about it. But if your blueberry plants are healthy, there is no sign of any stress symptoms, then don't worry about it. Now, with being said that, the cause of the poor quality or it doesn't taste that really good, sometimes it attributes to the rain. So when you have too much moisture, the sugar content actually in the fruits actually also going to be diluted quite a bit. So that's one of the reasons why you might be seeing pretty much a bland type of one. And in terms of those kind of like the stalk, the fruit stalk, the pedicels that has been sticking out, I really don't have an answer to that, why it is doing that. Say, maybe they need to mature a little bit longer, maybe. But I don't have a very good answer to that question.
Well, that's an interesting question, Darlene. Thank you very much for sharing that with us. I have noticed when we do get a lot of rain, the blueberries are a little bit diluted in flavor. Is that just with wild berries, or has that happened with the domesticated ones too, Vijay?
Even in the domesticated one, you'll typically find it not only in the blueberries, but any other type of berry fruits, actually, you know, including your, you know, raspberries, including your, strawberries as well, too, when you do have too much rain. So the fruits may look healthy and plumpy, but it's pretty much watery inside, not much sugar content in it. Now, the one thing I would keep, would make sure is that do fertilize your blueberry plants beginning from mid-May till about like mid-July. I mean, we are getting the August month. So make sure like, you know, fertilize them every 3 weeks or so, because when they produce that much of enough fruit, they are right now depleted quite a bit of reserved energy, which is needed actually for them to produce the fruit bud for next year. So, you know, make sure about it. If you don't fertilize them, probably the next year, you may not get the much of fruit quality, or they make the plant more vulnerable to winter stress as well.
Okay, great. Thank you. We got an email from Sarah in Plymouth. She says that her tomato plants are growing like crazy, and she knows all these buds won't set fruit, but when should she start topping them off to encourage the little green tomatoes to fill out?
So it depends on the variety. So if you do have an indeterminate varieties, you can let them keep on growing, actually. You don't necessarily have to top them, okay? Then Mother Nature will take care of it by, you know, in the fall time when we have a first frost, then probably it'll be done, actually. But if you do want to contain them, yeah, you can top them, but it'll stimulate more of those suckers, okay? The lateral, you know, buds will stimulate and produce more branches. In those kind of scenarios, you want to make sure that you have a good tomato cages
to support some of this lateral growth actually as well. Now, if your tomato fruits are not ripening, just be patient, actually. Give some more time for them, because once we have heat, we have right now, like last few days, we have about close to, 85, 90 degree kind of weather conditions. So it takes time actually for them to ripen actually. So be a little bit patient. I'm not worried about it right now, even though if the fruits are mature, they're not ripening. Don't get alarmed about it. If the same condition persists in the fall, then it is a different story. But right now, we are still still active in the growing season. So give some more time for the fruits to mature and ripe.
Okay. Deborah emailed us also, and she is wondering, when is the best time to move her rhubarb bed? Apparently, she lives in Vilas County, and they lost a well-established domestic raspberry patch to what looked like a rust, and it was on the edge of a wooded area in full sun, and it was heavily mulched with oak leaves. Is it possible that the mulch spread the disease? So a couple questions there.
Yeah, so the best time to transplant or move your rhubarb would be early in the springtime. That would be the best time to do. So in the springtime, the plants are still in dormant. You can scoop them out and then you can plant them. That will cause them a less stress for the plant and use enough time for them to acclimatize to the new growing zone or the new growing soil. And produce enough roots for them to thrive and establish. I do not recommend fall transplanting because we don't have enough time for them to acclimatize to the new planting site location. Now, with being said that, in raspberries, rhubarb, all these plants, they're highly susceptible to too much moisture. So they can get crown rot, root rot, all those different types of diseases. Now, on top of it, sometimes, whenever the spring comes in or the growing season comes in, we become like a mulch maniac. We tend to mulch everything.
It's true.
And mulch really helps, but it also has a disadvantage. It really helps, when we do have a dry summertime because it tends to cool the soil, conserve the soil moisture. But it has an opposite effect during in the rainy period. So when you have a frequent rain, it doesn't let the excess moisture evaporate. So it tends to make the more of a muggy and in muggy conditions in the soil, and makes it more vulnerable for the plant to get a root rot issue. So that could be one factor that could potentially contribute to those kind of issue in declining your plants in that site location. So the first thing I would do is to rake up some of those excess mulch away from the crown of the plant and check the root system. Just scrape around the base of the plant and look for some sort of like a thin, pencil size or less than pencil size root system, and send a sample to Dr. Brian Huddleston lab to get it tested. See if there's any discolorations of the roots. Maybe have a root rot or not. So send a sample, get it tested and verified to it. As far as actually, if you have a suspicion that the mulch is contaminated, can I use the same mulch for another different species? Generally, the root rots, there are different strains of root rot type species, and they're all very specific to certain host plants. Say, I doubt it, actually, the mulch that you use from your raspberry and you're putting on a rhubarb is going to affect the rhubarb plant. No, they are totally different species, and so I'm not worried. But if you are still not sure about it, you can always actually pile those contaminated mulch in a different location and let them compost it thoroughly, or you trash it. But before you tend to do all those things, send a sample, of your root sample or foliage sample or stem sample to Dr. Brian Huddleston lab to get it tested, verify whether you really have a disease issue or not.
And you can find that address at just Google UW is it Plant Diagnostic Lab, I believe, will.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a cost for doing it with a picture, but there's another, and there's an additional cost for sending in a sample. But that all the information is right there on the website. So
absolutely.
Yeah. And actually, I think Claire said she's going to put it on our episode page if you need a link to it too. So that's just WPR.org/Larry, and just look for this date, and you will see it there. So thank you, Clara. If you've got a question for Vijay, give us a call. We still have some time with him left. Our number is 800-642-1234, and the lines are all open, so you get in real quick. Also, you can send an email, and that address is talk@wpr.org. And Bob in Oregon called, but he couldn't stay with us, and he's wondering how to get wild blueberries to fruit.
Oh, that's a very good question. In certain areas, you know, blueberries do grow naturally because of the soil condition, the climatic conditions are suitable. Mostly there are low-growing type of blueberries, okay? So they form more of a mound, and then they tend to crawl on the ground surface. But, boy, the fruits are very tasty.
Yes, they are.
There is always a niche for this kind of wild type of blueberries because of the fruit are very spectacular, you know, in terms of its quality-wise. And so the blueberry picking in the wild is so famous because of that. But in terms of domesticating some of these wild blueberry plants, see, that's the biggest thing, because they're used to that kind of in a unique microclimatic condition and the soil type. When you scoop them out from that kind of natural area and try to plant them in your, domesticated type of landscape setting, things may not work out that really very well for them. And they may suffer from all kind of stress issue. The food quality will be also bad. So my best suggestion is, okay, let them be that, okay? Don't try to, hijack them from their natural landscape, appreciate it in the natural landscape. And so they are best suitable for in that kind of situation. Let it be that. But being said that, okay, so one other thing that I just like to mention, Jill, is that in my study, in a raised bed situation, I did some intercropping with some blueberry plants. So, blueberries, just a few years, it may be slow to grow, but in the meantime, you may have a plenty of spaces between one plant to another plant. So I introduced, lingonberries. Lingonberries are not that common in Wisconsin. It's a Swedish delicacy, and, the fruits are rich in antioxidants. So I introduced the lingonberries between the crops of the plant. They are amazing. So in those type of soilless media between the blueberry plants, they grow like a ground cover, and they produce a fruit beginning in second or third year. Their fruits are like a tiny pea shape, reddish in color, bit of a toddy taste to it, and they are easy to grow. They really prefer pot shaded areas. So if you have a situation, you have a blueberry plant, and probably you can also intercrop with some, lingonberries as well, too. So some of the lingonberry varieties like Scarlet, Regal, Balsed, they're all available online. You can plant them. They're very easy to grow down, okay? And same thing with the cranberries, too. We always have an assumption that the cranberries are mostly in central part of Wisconsin in a boggy and wet situation. But you can also grow them in a raised bed, and some of those varieties will act like a ground cover. Say Pilgrim is one of the common varieties, and Ben Leo is also another common variety of cranberry. So you can taste the natural cranberry fruit in the, late summer, early fall time. So these two different types of, ground cover type, you can also intercrop with your blueberry plant. So give a try and see how it has been performing in your garden, and let me know next time.
Yeah, I love that idea. I love that combination. It makes a whole lot of sense. Let's hear how that works out for you. Right now we have a phone call. Clark in Genoa City. Hi, Clark.
Hello.
Yep, go right ahead.
Yeah, I have an apple tree. I bought a home. I had a really big apple tree, and it wasn't producing apples, so I chopped it all up about 10 feet high and tried to force it to start making apples. I think they're golden delicious. They don't really ripen until really late in the fall, sweeten up. But the problem I have is they've got this like black scab on them, which really disfigures the apple. And I'm not sure. You know, I've tried fruit tree sprays, but it doesn't seem like it's doing anything. Not helping. So I don't know if there's anything I can do to try to rid this tree of this black scab that it has.
Okay. What do you think, VJ?
Well, apple scab, you know, it is very common this year. This year, with all the rain that we got, it is notorious. So you're not the only one. I think they, you know, many backyard gardeners, they have this issue, including your crabapple varieties as well, too. See, the problem with the apple scab issue is that the primary infection takes place in the springtime. So as soon as a new leaf emerges out, and when we get the first shower, actually, after the new leaf emerges, the infection takes place right at the time. And then it keeps on spreading. And that ruins not only the foliage, but also the fruit quality. As you see, actually, in your fruit, the black spot, which are cracks on it, and all those things. So this year has been notorious for it. So it is too late to do anything. The best what you can do, actually, is that after you're done with the harvesting or anything, okay, rake up all those fallen leaves and compost it or trash it. But that's not going to save you for next year as well. And all you have to blame is the rain. And because when the Mother Nature is overwhelming that much of humidity, it is a perfect condition for it. Now, there are some spray treatments available for scab using some sort of fungicide. The timing is more important. So many times people think about like, yeah, one-time spray. When I go, actually, I see the infection taking place right now on my leaf, then I'm going to spray it. Then it is too late. So these fungicides that has been recommended are preventive fungicide, which means that before the infection takes place, you need to spray it. So when I talked to you a few seconds ago, the infection typically happens, the primary infection happens, when you start to have the first leaves forms and then the rain drops. That's where the infection happens. When you miss that crucial time right up there to spray a preventive fungicide at that time, then probably the whole game actually is done. So which means that no matter what, afterwards you spray any of this fungicide, it's not going to work, okay? So these are all preventive fungicide. So that's one of the reasons why many homeowners and backyard gardeners struggle in keeping up with the apple scab, okay? Because we are not a commercial people. In a commercial industry, like an apple growers industry, every 14 days they keep up with this regimen of spraying for apple scab, prevent them, especially during in the springtime. Say in homeowner setting, it is not possible, unfortunately.
Yeah, sorry about that, Clark. Are there some new varieties that are less likely to get it? Are they developing those?
They're developing varieties for fire blight issue, but in terms of like really for preventing scab, I'm not really sure. So far, I haven't heard it, but if you do hear it, let me know. I haven't heard from a state specialist yet, Amaya Tucha, about it. But there are a lot of fire blight, which is actually a bacterial disease that will kill the tree. There are some rootstock varieties that are really resistant to it. But for scab infection, I'm not really sure.
Okay. We've got an email from Nita in Nakusa. She is saying that she has a large clump of ornamental grass, and she's asking when would be the best time to break apart the clump and transplant it, and is there a certain way to break away from that large clump?
So generally, spring is the best time for me to recommend transplanting or dividing any type of perennials, including your ornamental grass. Say when your ornamental grass is more than like a 4 or 5 years old, or even older than that. So what happens is that then the middle portion of those grasses will tend to decline and they'll tend to rot. Whereas the surrounding one looks more healthy. It kind of looks like a donut-shaped type of format. You will see at that.
Yeah.
So when you get to that kind of situation, all you have to do, depending on the type of ornamental grasses, especially if you're dealing with some like a miscanthus type or something like that,
you really need actually a very sharp shovel or even sometimes an axe, okay? Say you actually, you know, you split them, you know, just like a splitting a cake, you know, you tear them apart into four or five different pieces using a sharp shovel. And then, you know, you can take each clump out of those things and shake off some of the excess dirt or something like that, and you can plant them, you know, any place what you want. So my best suggestion would be spring is the best time before the new shoots appear. While they're still in dormant would be the best time to transplant it.
Is that pretty much the case with most of our perennials?
Most perennials, but there are some perennials like irises, peonies, you know, those are exceptions. Fall is the best time for them to divide and transplant them. But other than that, the majority of the perennials, early spring is the best time.
I was really hoping to postpone dividing my peonies until next spring. I guess I have a lot of work cut out for me.
Yeah. Fall is the best time. They are a bit finicky about it. Mm-hmm. Iris, the same thing too. And fall is the best time to do that.
Okay. We had Warren in central Wisconsin who called but couldn't stay with us. He thinks he has bacterial wilt in his garden. It's on his cantaloupe, watermelon, and cucumbers. And he's wondering, is there a cure?
Well, the very first thing to do is actually send a sample to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, Dr. Brian Huddleston. Like I said, if you Google up Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic or you check on the WPR website, you know, they have posted it. So send a sample. The thing about the bacterial disease is that they get spread by the cucumber beetles, okay? And when you spot them, if you feel that it's a suspicious or bacterial mold, they have a very unique characteristic. Say, during in the daytime, the leaves will wilt. Only in the evening, they actually, you know, looks fresh. They will, you know, looks normal. If you do find these kind of symptoms like that initially, then there is a good suspicion it could be a bacterial well. Unfortunately, not much can be done on the infected plant. I would bag the infected plant right away, and I would trash it, okay, because the infection can spread. So in order to prevent the spread to a healthy plant, you know, you tend to do that. At the same time, send a sample to the disease diagnostic clinic and check for the, you know, test result. And Dr. Brian Huddleston will give you some recommendation how to minimize it. Generally, like I said, I don't know there is any effective sprays available for it. But the best thing to do is to also knock out some of the cucumber beetle, because these are the main vectors that spreads, actually, one of the main vectors that spreads actually the bacterial diseases.
And so should we be using, like, what, soapy water again, like we do with the Japanese beetle?
So in terms of that, for the first thing, bag it. Second of all, inspect your plant on a regular basis to check for cucumber beetles. And if you do find it, the cucumber beetles, I mean, soapy water is not going to do anything. None of the bugs.
Not for these.
You know, these are tough beetles.
Okay.
So we do have an extension fact sheet that really talks about, you know, controlling your cucumber beetles, okay? Mm-hmm. Especially if you do have a large numbers, okay? You really don't have a choice, but you need to spray for it. So check our extension fact sheet that talks about cucumber beetle management. But regular scouting is very important to see if you have a huge numbers of cucumber beetles or not. But if you don't want to spray anything, then probably you can use some sort of like a floating row cover. And that acts like a barrier. But the problem is that when your plants are in bloom, you need to let the pollinators to come and pollinate.
Right.
So in those kind of scenarios, you need to take the floating row cover off and let the pollination take place, and then you put them back again.
All right. Well, thank you so much, VJ. We really appreciate you spending some time with us today and sharing your expertise.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Appreciate it. Our guest on Garden Talk today was VJ Pandian. He's a horticulture educator for the UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. Stay with us. We have another expert joining us to talk about keeping your planters looking great. Are you planters looking a little sad right now. Mine are okay. But up next, we're going to talk about how to create and maintain them throughout the growing season. I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is Garden Talk. And today, we're welcoming Chris Hendrickson to the studio. He and his wife, Angie, are owners of K&A Greenhouse, two of them located in Verona and Fitchburg. He has advice on how to make those containers look good. Give us a call if you need some, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hey, Chris, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm glad that we were able to offer you some AC today because I imagine it's pretty hot working outside.
It is most days, absolutely. This is a bit of a change for me. Usually I'm answering questions in like 100-degree weather. So this is, this is a joy. I got my emotional support coffee here, so I'm ready to rock and roll.
Well, I'm glad. So if you've got a call for Chris or a question for Chris, give us a call, 800-642-1234. So first off, Chris, tell us about K&A Greenhouse.
Yes, we have two locations in the Madison area. It's been around since 1986. That was before my time, but my wife and I took it over in 2005 when I was right out of college. I have, like a lot of people in the horticulture industry, I have came by horticulture a little differently. I have 2 degrees, not in horticulture, elementary education and history. And then I worked at K&A one summer. My wife, or I should say my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, was kind enough to get me a job there. And I really enjoyed it. It's a great place to be. We have just the loveliest people you can imagine. And it's been kind to us over the years. And so it's been a good industry to be in, especially we had a lot of times for COVID. When COVID started, it was a very difficult time for us. But it was also very rewarding as people would come in. And you realize that plants mean a lot to people. And so that was a good feeling.
Well, you come highly recommended. So
all right.
The pressure is on.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we wanted to just focus in today on creating and taking care of planters because a lot of people don't even have room for anything but that is a planter. So let's just start with the basics in what do you look for in a container?
In any container, the first thing you want to look for is what sun you have. That's going to be the first thing. You don't want to be fighting the sun. The plant has to match the sun that you're doing. Mm-hmm. So if you're getting full sun, which is really anywhere from 6 to 8 hours of sun, afternoon sun being the hottest, part sun is going to be more 4 to 6 hours or full morning sun kind of thing. So that's the first thing that I look for. The other thing is to make sure that you are getting a container that is sized appropriately for the plants that you want. A lot of times we have people that will come in and they'll want to do like a wave petunia or some type of other very vigorous growing plant, and you don't want to put that in too small of a container. The soil that you use is another huge important thing. We have a lot of folks that will, and I'm not knocking it 100%, but a lot of the big box stores will sell potting soil that is just not really at the quality it needs to be. It's a lot like cooking where the ingredients really, really matter. So those are some of the things we look out right from the get-go. The material, a lot of times people talk about terracotta or plastic or that kind of thing, not as important to me as really just making sure you give your plants enough room. Not using old potting mix is another big thing, too. And then watering practices and all sorts of other things that we can go into for sure.
What about like drainage holes? I'm assuming that's kind of important.
It absolutely is. If you have an indoor plant, it's not necessarily as important because you're the one who's going to dictate how much water goes into that. If you have an outdoor planter, though, and it rains and rains and rains, it's not going to kill your plant if you have drainage in there. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, and then ample drainage, too. Sometimes we'll have big containers that won't have enough holes in there. You can put a little bit of gravel, 2 or 3 inches up on it to help with that. Give a little reservoir for it to drain out as well. But drainage is absolutely important. And that also goes to the soil as well. A lot of times you have people are very worried about making sure that they have a soil that retains enough moisture. And a lot of times that is going to be, it can, be too much moisture for it to be holding on to. There's several products out there like Soil Moist and some of these other ones that, in my opinion, hold too much moisture. And you really want your plants to be able to dry out between waterings.
I think that's a key point, too. So many of us is like, oh, it's a little dry on top. Let's water it again. That's not the great way to do it, is it?
It's not because a lot of times people come in and they'll say, oh, I was checking the watering by sticking my finger in the potting mix. And it's like, well, great. Now you know what the first 2 inches are. And a lot of times it just doesn't tell you the whole story. There's a lot of also products out there like self-watering. which I'm not really a big fan of as well, because especially when you early plant these, the idea for these self-watering is that it's going to wick the material up, or the water, I should say, up from the bottom. But if you just have a newly planted planter, you're not going to have any roots to the bottom of that container. So that's not really where it's at as well. So I recommend if you can pick up a container and do the weight of it. Now, that's not, you know, possible if you have some very large ones. But a lot of times the lightweight ones or a smaller 10, 12, 14-inch ones, you can give it a pickup. And that'll tell you really how much water is in there. And the more you do that, the more you're going to be able to figure out, oh, yes, this is really light. Oh, this is really heavy. And that's going to give you a better picture of really when you need to water something and when you don't. And that's definitely true for hanging baskets especially as well.
And with this year, with our so much rain, how is that affecting our containers?
It really depends on the type of plant that you had in there. Calibrachoas or mini petunias are a really good example of something that did not fare well with that amount of water. And, you know, there's other things that petunias and some of the other ones that are heavier water needs. And that's also case by case. If you have a smaller container and Mother Nature's watering a lot more than you were probably maybe doing, then maybe your stuff did really, really well. So there's no necessarily great way for containers to say how it affected each and every one of them.
Yeah, I think I've maybe watered my containers 5 or 6 times this year, which is crazy considering last year.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a night and day difference from what we had going on last year.
Yeah. And my geraniums aren't doing great this year. Have you found that to be true?
Yeah. Calibrachoas, geraniums, a lot of the stuff that wants to be dry between waterings that's not getting it. And that's another reason why using a better quality potting mix is more important, because if you're using, there's like a Miracle-Gro, and I'm not knocking all their products, but they have a organic mix that is very heavy, very dense. Some of the lower quality potting mixes that you can buy, you know, when you're $9 a bag, $10 a bag kind of stuff that are really, really heavy. Well, their water retention is very, very high. They use a lot of mineral soil and not a soilless mix necessarily. So in between the rains, it's just not drying out enough.
So you're looking for a soilless mix for your planters?
More or less, or okay. Primarily a soilless mix.
Okay.
The varieties that we, or I should say the brand that we sell, we have a house brand that we really, really like. And every year we go out and try to find another brand or something that might be better. We're always trying to improve everything that we do. And so, yeah, we'll get in 5 or 6 different types of them. And, you know, usually I haven't had, or I should say in the last 5 years, we haven't changed our mix whatsoever. Because when we compare to something that's even a little bit more cost effective for the consumer, the quality drop is just unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that when people come into the store and have problems with containers, that's one of the first questions I ask. Where did you get your soil? Did you use last year's soil? And there's just sort of a litany you don't want me to go through here about of all the different questions I can ask.
Oh, I'm sure. So when we do have, you said don't use last year's soil, but when we have a big container, that can get a little expensive. So
it absolutely can. You can cheat it a little bit. The real rule is that if you have a container where the roots are not going to go all the way to the bottom, then you can leave last year's soil as a filler. That's going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
You can cheat a little bit and have the, you can kind of add a little bit of a solar release fertilizer or an Osmocote to that at the bottom, kind of to sort of freshen it up. But a lot of those soils or the soilless mixes are made with peat moss. And a lot of that peat moss has a wetting agent in it. And that wetting agent will deteriorate over time. And although peat is found in bogs, essentially, it's actually a hydrophobic substance. And so if you don't have that wetting agent or it wears out over time, it takes a lot to resaturate your old peat. And so you really only want to use it for, you know, the bottom quarter of a container or even a third. But anywhere the roots are going, you really want to do fresh potting soil and a high-quality potting soil.
Okay, that makes a whole lot of sense. Now, when it comes to selecting the plants, I know there's so many that you can pick from, but what kind of rule of thumb do you have when you're helping people select plants for their containers?
There really isn't necessarily one rule of thumb. I mean, like I said, it starts more with the sun requirements first and foremost, and then it's going to be a maintenance to some degree. And one of the things that we have a lot of folks that come in and they'll say, well, I don't want anything that says maintenance. And it's just impossible when you have that kind of, you have a live thing that's growing, that's flowering. When the flower's done and it's spent, you have to pick it off. It wants to go to seed, so you want to pick off those seed pods. So yeah, there isn't necessarily one hard or fast thing I look for. It's more about matching, you know, a lower care plant for somebody that doesn't want to do too much. And yeah, I mean, really, other than that, it's really about what kind of look the customer wants for it. And I think the big thing for us is that we try to have as much staff on hand as possible so we can walk around with people, show them different options, because it's, you know, we do this day in, day out, but it's something that somebody does maybe a few weekends a year. And there's some hardcore gardeners that'll come in all the time. But for a lot of folks, it's not something that they're normally doing on a day-to-day basis. So your local garden center should be able to help you and walk you around. And I think that's one of the big differences we have between us and like a big box store. We're there to help you and to assist you, and we don't expect you to be an expert. We're happy to be that for you.
Because you aren't doing, that's an investment, no matter where you're buying it. So you should buy it with knowledge, with knowledgeable people, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You should, you know, and that'll help. And the other thing is, too, is that you don't want to skimp on and cut corners. You know, we have a lot of folks, we sell a ton of plants and not nearly enough soil to fill the containers for those plants. So one of the things we've been doing is being a bit more vocal with like, okay, what kind of potting soil do you have, to prevent people from, oh, I got a, it just says potting soil, I got it for $5 at, you know, Menards or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure they might have a higher quality mix, but I already know that you're going to have a potting soil that has more water retention, has more mineral soil in it. So you're going to be fighting that. So if you're spending, you know, even $50, $100, some people are up there $200, $300 in flowers, it's worth the extra investment in the soil as well.
Yeah, you don't want to see my plant bill.
Yeah. Maybe I do, actually.
Oh,
right?
Maybe you know, you
I got bills to pay. I'd be all right with that.
We're talking with Chris Hendrickson, owner of K&A Greenhouse. What questions do you have about containers? Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us next week. We're going to be talking to two authors, and the first book is going to be talking about bird-friendly gardening, and then the second hour, we're going to talk about ground cover. So many options for that, but right now, we are talking about containers, and we're going to go to the phone. We have Joe in Whitewater with a question. Go ahead, Joe.
Hi, Jill. Thanks for taking my call. Chris, nice to talk to you again. I've been to your store a couple of times. You and your staff are just excellent.
Thank you, Joe.
My patio plant, yeah, you're welcome. My patio plants right now are doing quite well, but I'm concerned this fall I've got a patio rosemary plant that I try to bring in every fall, and I do, but it dies. So I'm just wondering if you've got any tips or tricks that I can use to maybe let it last until the holidays, maybe?
Those are so hard to keep going. I was so proud of myself. I did one once right here, and that was it.
So there is a lot of things that you can do for that. It is a difficult plant. Any of the herbs that you want to bring inside, rosemaries, basils, any of that stuff, the real trick is that they're going to want to desiccate, and that's the issue that you have. So when you bring them inside, you want to give them as much light as you possibly can. You don't want to move them very much. You don't want to put them in anywhere where you're going to have like a heating vent. You don't want to encourage any of that desiccation or any of that drying out. Sometimes people will put a container or like a larger dish underneath them with pebbles and water in there to try to keep that humidity up, because it's going to want to be a little bit more, you know, that 40 to 50 sort of humidity range, which is easy for us to get in the summer. But in the winter, that's something that if you're not pumping in or have a house humidifier, that you might not be reaching. You can also mist them. Which some people, there's a little bit of mixed information on that, because if you overdo it, now you're encouraging various blights and other things to happen to it. So it's, you sort of have to do that maybe once a week or so. But one of the biggest things too is that you're not having that thrive. You're not going to get it to thrive throughout the winter. The days are too short. There's not enough sunshine. It's about surviving. So I think that's one of the big things for people when they bring, you know, a geranium or anything. If you don't have a sunroom where you're able to add extra lighting or any supplemental lighting, you're really just trying to get it to survive, and it's going to start going downhill from the moment you put it inside. And then as soon as you can get it outside, even for a little bit of duration when the temperatures are 55, you know, maybe it's even in April, or if you get lucky, maybe in March, and give it a little bit of that outdoor weather, it'll start to really, really come back. But I think that's the big thing, is to give yourself a little grace with, you know, in January, February, even in December, it's not going to look good. It'll drop needles. You'll have a lot of issues with it. But in general, it's about getting it to survive till the temperature gets better. And it's, you know, unless you want to add a whole light rig from Jeff Bezos or something, you're not going to really necessarily knock it out of the park.
But just keep trying, Joe. That's the important thing.
Absolutely.
One thing I was wondering about when you do something like that, I mean, how wet do you keep that soil? Because that's usually my problem.
That's a good point. You're not going to be watering it. I mean, that's another big thing is to pick it up. So if you have a container that you can pick up, this is a perfect example of you want it to dry out very well between waterings. You don't want to be watering it every week even. It might be every 2 weeks, but it's very dependent. If you have a sunroom and it's doing a bit better and it's soaking up some water, well, then you're going to be watering it and you maybe even will fertilize it once a month or something like mm-hmm. that. But if it's, you know, in the sunniest place you can, kind of adjacent to a window and the best you can do, I mean, it might be once a month that you're doing it. It also depends if it's a topiary or what type of rosemary it is and how large it is. So.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Let's go to Gary in New Ulm. Go ahead, Gary.
Hello.
Gary, are you there? Oh, I think we lost Gary, but he had a question about a hanging basket. Can you just give us some general information about hanging baskets?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead.
So when it comes to hanging baskets, we have a lot of folks that want their hanging baskets to go all season long, and that can be very, very difficult to do, especially when it gets to the heat of summer. One of the things you can do if you're buying like a 10-inch hanging basket is that in June or July, you want to up its, the size of it. So if you have a 10-inch basket, if you pot that into a 12-inch, give it a little pinch back, that'll make a big difference for the longevity of it. It might not seem like you're adding that much soil to it, but even an inch or two all the way around it is going to rejuvenate that plant quite a bit. The other thing is that there's a fair amount of maintenance that comes with hanging baskets, and it depends. I mean, I could talk for way longer than you want me to about the different varieties of stuff and how they affect if you don't care for them. But a lot of times people are, they wait too long to do things like pinching them back. Petunias are a good example of that. When they get really, really leggy, well, now you have to cut it back very severely. So anytime you can pinch a plant back a little bit prematurely when it just starts to look a little bit off, that will make a big difference. Fertilizing your plants, especially your hanging baskets, because they have a finite amount of space. 9 out of 10 times, your container plants are going to have 50, 100% more soil than a hanging basket will. Another thing is with hanging baskets, and we are guilty of this as anybody else is that they are a bit more overcrowded. So to get a very full hanging basket, you can have, you know, 4 or 5 upwards of plants in a smaller space, so you get that lovely intermixed look. However, that just means you have that much more of a root mass in a confined space. Mm-hmm. So you can add an extra, you know, up potting them is one thing. Fertilize regularly is another huge thing, at least once a week. People struggle a lot with petunias because they're not adding a higher acid fertilizer, which is very, very important. But yeah, that's just some of the general stuff. And the other thing is too, is give yourself a little grace because you're not, if you're traveling and you're, you know, out and about and doing stuff, you're going to have times when your baskets are going to take a bit of a beating. And if you get, you know, hot, dry days and it, you know, takes a beating on your baskets, you're going to have to cut them back. You're going to have to wait a little while for them to come back. And it's just, you know, it's kind of how it goes a lot of times.
I solve my problems with hanging baskets. I don't buy them anymore.
Oh, God, I thought you were going to tell me you do fake flowers. And I was going to be like,
no, never.
I was like, no, please, no.
No, but I just don't buy them anymore because I'm terrible hanging basket mom.
If you have that, though, go with a larger size. Yeah. One of the things we do is we do a 14-inch or a 13-inch basket. We try to upsize them a little bit. It has a much, you know, people will notice it looks like it has a little bit of a larger, you know, a container size for the basket. And it really, really does. Mm-hmm. The other big thing that I notice a lot is if I go into greenhouses or whether it's a big box store, which I rarely ever leave the shop, so it's a rare occasion. But in early spring, especially, I'll see baskets that are really large. And to me, that's just sort of not what you want in a hanging basket. The life of that hanging basket is already halfway gone. So we try to sell ours that are the plants are just to the, you know, the edge of the pot. And we'll have people come in and say, oh, these are too small. And like, yeah, they're too small because on May 1st, I don't want to be selling a basket that is really blown out and is too big. I want you to enjoy that process rather than have, you know, half of that process happen in our shop. So I think that's one of the big things to do is if you're, you know, struggling with a 10-inch basket, yes, it costs a bit more money, but maybe go up in size or start with a 10-inch basket and then pot it up. Mm-hmm. And that'll help you to sort of have it keep going and going and going.
That's a really good point, because we do like to buy the things that look so pretty.
Yes, absolutely. And we will we unsell things all the time. People will take begonias and things that are really warm weather, tropical things that, you know, we're not in Papua New Guinea right now in April in Wisconsin. And so you really, if it looks super tropical, it's not meant for, our area. And that's something that we'll say to people. Say, I don't think you want to get these yet. You want to wait till it warms up a bit.
Sure. Yeah, that makes total sense. Now let's talk about designing that basket.
All right.
So there's three elements that I've always heard about: the chiller, the filler, and the thriller.
Thriller, fillers, and spillers.
And spillers. That's it. Okay.
If you look on YouTube, there's like a 2008 video of me as a still bald man, but younger man on Channel 3 talking about it. Yeah. The idea is really that you want to put something in the center that will wow you or that you'll see from a distance. That's true for containers. It's not as necessarily true for hanging baskets, but for containers, you want to match the height of what you're going to put around it too. So if you need to get some real verticality, then you want to do that. A filler is going to be sort of more of your flower power, your petunias, scaviolas. There's a lot of different things you can do for that. And a spiller is something that's going to give your container a little bit of interest that's going to hang over. A lot of times for hanging baskets, you're going to fill those containers with more mounding or semi-trailing type of things and not be trying to get something in the center that's necessarily too tall. But yeah, there's a lot of different names for it: thrillers, fillers, and spillers. That's kind of the gist of it.
Mm-hmm. So how many plants do you generally put into the container? Because I tend to go a little overboard because I'm like, oh, that'll look great, this will look great, and then they get too big.
Absolutely. It's a common occurrence that we see, sometimes in reverse, too. Sometimes we have people that'll be, I'll put these three things in an 18-inch pot, and it's like it'll fill in over time. I would say it really depends on the container, and in a 12-inch pot, you might put five things in there. I mean, you can put more in there, but you really want to make sure that you're guarding against overfilling your containers, because you'll have a problem later in the season when they get to the size that they're supposed to. The other thing, too, is if you struggle with mixed containers or you're always overstuffing containers, sometimes doing an assorted pot where you put like a 14-inch pot with a 10-inch pot and an 8-inch pot, and you have a little set there, a little vignette, then you can put just one pot in an 8 or one plant in an 8-inch pot, maybe another plant in the 10-inch, and then sort of, mirror that in a larger pot as well. And, that's a good way to make sure you're not overplanting something. But in a 10-inch container, I might put three pot plants, maybe four if I'm feeling, gutsy. In a 14 or 16 or 18, you can go up. And then a lot of times that thriller, when you get up to that size pot, is going to take up a lot more room. So, you might put in a 24-inch pot, you might put only five plants, but that centerpiece might be a banana plant or a purple fountain grass or something that's really going to give you that verticality, but at the expense of definitely eating up a lot of that space. It's also important when you're putting that container together, to make sure that you're matching some of the water requirements. One of the things that we especially help people with is if you're taking like a lantana, which is more of an arid kind of deserty plant, and you're mixing it with something like a king tut grass, which is a papyrus grass, you're mixing a water hog plant with an arid plant, and it's going to end usually badly. And so you want to make sure that you're matching the water requirements, or you're understanding that, if I'm watering this container, I want to water the center of it more. So that's just another little side note about that, is that you want to make sure that it's not just how many plants you're putting in it, but the type of them and the overall size at maturity.
Mm-hmm. Do you usually, and we only got a couple more minutes left, but if you're going to do up a fall planter, what are some of your favorite plants to use?
This is a tough one, because one of the things that I sort of take issue with in our industry is that there's a lot of fall plants, and like I said, we're guilty of them because consumers want them, but you'll see pepper plants. You'll see plants that are meant for warm environments in fall containers, and they're the first ones to go. So for fall stuff, though, I would stay away from those types of things and go for your kales, go for your cabbages, mix in some mums. You can do a purple fountain grass or a grass as well, but those type of keeping it simple with three or four elements makes a big difference. The grasses, even though a purple fountain grass will die at the first chance of frost, it is fine when it dries out. So it looks like a dry derangement. And your kales and cabbages can look good with snow on them.
They do.
Yeah.
They
so
do.
I think that's some of the things. Also, picking a mum variety makes a difference, too.
Okay, great. Well, we've used up all of our time. Thank you so much, Chris. We really appreciate it. This is Garden Talk, and I want to thank all of our people on the team, Claire Neipert, Joel Patnod, technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and, of course, our Larry Mueller. I'm Jill Nadeau, your friendly neighborhood executive producer. Enjoy your weekend.